أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد والثناء لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، باعث الأنبياء والمرسلين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل
وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المكرمين المنتجبين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأراضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين لتراب مقدمه الفداء، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين إلى قيام يوم الدين. For the hastening and the return of our Imam, please recite the salawat.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
We pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has accepted all of the worships, the fasting of the brothers and sisters. We hope and pray that we are given the tawfiq by Allah to truly benefit from this month. We are almost midway through the month of Ramadan. And I hope at the end of the month of Ramadan, for myself, I hope and pray that I can look back and not feel that this month of Ramadan went by as well and I wasn't able to gain much, and I regret that I didn't recite Quran enough, and I regret that I did not wake up before Fajr to do ibadah and worship the du'as. We need to stop postponing things for the next day and what next night and the next year and the next month. We have to take advantage of this month. One of the ways we've been trying to over these nights take advantage of this month is to speak of, remember the Ahlul Bayt. Because their remembrance is ibadah and worship. And we have hope that if the intentions are sincere, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepts this as worship and it helps. It's one of the a'mal that we're doing on these nights. And we are learning about our role models, those who we are supposed to refer to and consider as uswa, as a model, as a role model to look up to, that we have very little knowledge of. Misinformation that we have about them instead of information and knowledge. We're trying to get better knowledge of them, and through that, hopefully, get closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, especially by implementing these teachings. We've spoken about the Ahlul Bayt one by one, starting with the Holy Prophet, and tonight we are on the 11th Imam, Imam Hasan al-Askari, salamullahi alayhi. The Imams, each and every one of them, discussing them, understanding them, has been a challenge, truly, to really see what they've done, what they've accomplished. And trying to explain that has been a challenge. Imam Hasan al-Askari is a bit more challenging compared to some of the other Ahlul Bayt, some of the other Imams. The reason is, or one of the reasons is, that this Imam lived the life of Imam, or as an Imam, as a leader, for only 6 years. The Imam was born in 232, and his Shahada is in 260. That makes 28 years. Out of these 28 years, 22 years, he was with his father, Imam al-Hadi. The imamah of the imam, when he takes over the leadership of the Muslim ummah, he starts to lead the believers, starts to lead the Shia. He only is able to do it for 6 years. it's challenging to understand exactly what the Imam did. But we would like to spend this time and do the best we can to try to understand what the Imam did. The first thing I need to explain to try to understand the time of this Imam, what he was able to accomplish, which is of course a point that helps us understand what happened during the time of Imam al-Hadi as well, a bit more, and what happened during the time of Imam al-Jawad as well. And that is, after Ma'mun, eventually what happened to Bani al-Abbas was that the corruption started to increase beyond what it used to be before them. And the government of the Abbasids, because of that corruption, and because of also the teachings, the instructions, the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, that caused them to lose the public support that they would have had, even to the extent that the predecessors had, this caused the governments to become very weak. We have sometimes, over the course, for example, of the Imam of Imam al-Hadi, there are over four khalifas that come and go. There are over four khalifas that come and go during the time of the Imam of Imam al-Hadi, from the year 220 to the year 254, that Imam al-Hadi is the Imam. There's about four khalifas that come and go. Before that, you don't see this. The way they come and go is also very interesting. Why? Because you see that within the Abbasids, there are instances of treason. You have one of the Abbasids attacking the other, the son killing the father to take over the throne. It reaches a stage where nobody within the Abbasid class of rulers and governors, the family of Bani al-Abbas that is ruling the Muslim Empire, there is very little trust. Everybody's plotting to kill each other, and everybody is feeling the fear that maybe this guy, this commander, this ruler of this region, this governor of this region, that brother of the Khalifa is going to be coming and plotting to kill the Khalifa or kill someone else. There's a lot of insecurity in the class that is ruling the Muslim Empire. We explained that for these reasons, Bani al-Abbas brought people in that were new to Islam. They didn't know much about Islam. And the only reason why they came and started becoming soldiers and serving the Khalifa was for no religious reason, for no ideological reason, but rather simply because where they came from, Central Asia for example, which is where some of them came from, the Turks, as they are mentioned in our books of history, they came from Central Asia, they were used to that type of lifestyle. They had kings, they had monarchs. Now you've become, and you've come part of the advanced Islamic Empire. Let's not forget, the Islamic Empire at that time is considered one of the world's superpowers, and it seems like it is the world superpower at that time. So people from that area have come in, and now they're working for the ruler, the king of a much larger state, a much larger monarchy. The descriptions of the corruption we have of these people is such that later on, one of the Abbasids, if I remember his name correctly, it is Mu'tamid, when he comes in, he feels that he wants to change things a bit, not for God, but it appears that that is his style of government. Recite a salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad.
He comes in and he says he wants to be similar to what we mentioned with regards to Ma'mun. Ma'mun liked to be viewed in a way that he saw Ali ibn Musa is viewed. He wanted to be seen as a pious man. He wanted to be seen as a scholar. He wanted to be seen as an intellectual. He didn't want to be seen as a ruthless ruler that he actually was. He didn't want people to see that. He didn't want people to feel that. He wanted people to think that he's a very pious man. Mu'tamid seems to have had similar ambitions, and he referred to the example of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz during the Umayyads. Out of all the Umayyad kings, they weren't really khulafa, out of the Umayyad kings, Umar ibn Abdul Aziz is someone that in history has a bit of respect compared to the rest of the Umayyads. Why? Because of showing a bit of piety, showing that he wasn't a drunkard, he wasn't someone that was into corruptions with women and so on and so forth, and praying, acting as though he's zahid, avoiding some of the glamour of the dunya. Umar ibn Abdul Aziz is known as that. This Khalifa tried to do that. This Abbasid Khalifa, it happens during the time of Imam al-Hadi, of course, but it's to give us what the Abbasid dynasty has turned into. He decides that he would like to be someone that is like Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, gets some respect from the people, gets some respect from those who read history later on. So he starts doing that. They say there were thousands of dinars spent on each meal in the palace of the Khalifa. He lowered it to 100 dirhams. Okay. From thousands of dinars to 100 dirhams. He started publicly going and being the one that participates in courts to make sure that the qadi, the judge, is going to judge in accordance to Islamic rule. He would be engaging in prayer. He would wake up in the middle of the night and he would engage in prayer. He wouldn't wear extravagant clothing. He would do all of that. When he did this, what do you think happened? These same people that the Khalifa had brought, the Turks, the other new Muslims that were not really Muslim, they just accepted Islam, but they were not trained into being Muslim, because in the previous dynasties, if there is a want that when people come into the Islamic state, the Islamic empire, there was a want for them to become actual Muslims, and so they would learn, and that's how some of the scholars became the Persians that became that came to Islam later on. They became great scholars. There was a want that new people that come into the Islamic empire, for them to become real Muslims. During the time of the Abbasids, especially at this time, that wasn't really something that was wanted. Keep them the way they are, because if they don't learn Islam, then they would follow orders the way that the Khalifa, the king, wanted. So now that the Khalifa, the king, is trying to act pious, what happens? His own people attack him. Those Turks and others come to him and they get him, and before they kill him, they tell him, "What the heck do you think you're doing?" And he tells them, "You know, I want to be like this, like that, and so on and so forth." He said, "But your people aren't here because of God. They're not here. The soldiers aren't here because of piety, because of any of that. The reason why they're here is for the dunya. For the power, for the wealth, for the money, for the cash, for the privileges." So even if somebody wanted to change the way the Abbasids were going to rule, their own people would attack them and kill them and finish them off. This is how corrupt it had become. And unstable. But what did Imam al-Askari do? What are the accomplishments that this beloved Imam of ours over the course of 6 years is supposed to be doing? Of course, obviously, as we've seen over the nights, it isn't such that an Imam comes and he does something that only he does. We see a continuum from the time of the Holy Prophet all the way to the end. And we see each of the ma'sumin is doing their share to accomplish the same goal. They judge the circumstances at their time, and they make decisions to carry out and make sure they accomplish that goal that all of the Ahlul Bayt are trying to accomplish. We see that. But the tactics that are used are slightly different. And then we see during certain stages of the lives of the Ahlul Bayt, one or two or three of the Imams are doing something that the others didn't do. We see that Imam Al-Askari, along with Imam Al-Hadi and Imam Al-Jawad, engaged in something that had to be finished off with Imam Al-Askari that was extremely important. But before I explain that, which I feel is the most important part of what the Imam did, I do need to explain some of the advancements in that overall movement that we talked about during the time of Imam Al-Askari. To understand why the Imam was assassinated only 6 years after he takes on the leadership of the Muslim Ummah. Only 6 years. This seems to be the shortest time of Imamah that any of the Imams has had. His life was 28, and the only other Imam that lived less than that is Imam Al-Jawad, but the Imamah of Imam Al-Jawad was longer than that. The Imam of Imam Al-Jawad in the 25 years of his life was for 17 years, when he was 8 until he was 25. But Imam Al-Askari, he lived 28 years, but his Imamah leadership is only for 8 years. Why? Why is he poisoned in that very secret way? That was difficult, again, as we mentioned about the previous Imams as well. It was difficult to spot even as poisoning. It was seen to be a disease, an illness, which is not the case. And also, why measures that were taken? Why did the Imam take measures about the 12th Imam? Why was it that the Imam, the 12th Imam, would have to go into occultation right at the beginning? Why? Why did the Imam have to even conceal the pregnancy of his wife, the mother of the 12th Imam? That had to be kept secret. It says that the mother of the Imam, according to a few of the accounts we have by the aunt of Imam Al-Askari, it says that one night she was called, the night of the birth of the 12th Imam, according to the account, the night of 15th of Sha'ban, she is called over by the Imam, and the Imam tells her, "I would like to give the good tidings that the Hujjah of Allah is going to be born later on this evening, before at around Fajr time is when the 12th Imam is born." And she says, "But I haven't, when who's pregnant? There's no sign, there's no..." He says, "It's Narjis that is pregnant." She goes over and she looks at her, she sees her, there's no sign of pregnancy. And she starts to doubt, and the Imam tells her that, "No, don't be doubtful. This is like the mother of Prophet Musa, those harsh circumstances, and it's important." See, the Imam is telling us why this is happening. This is one of the clues. He says, at the time of Prophet Musa, they were taking the children, the boys, and they were beheading them. They were not allowing mothers to even bear children. If they knew a woman is pregnant, they would make sure she doesn't have that child, and she doesn't give birth to that child alive. They would make sure of that. So because of that, according to this account, he says, the mother of Musa was also like this. It didn't show that she's pregnant. And she didn't even feel, apparently, according to the account. Why all of this? Why is it that nobody's invited to the ceremony of the birth of the son of the Imam, the next Imam? We have to understand this. What happens? Why? Why does this happen? Remember, we talked about how gradually the movement of the Ahlul Bayt has picked up its momentum. It's moved from the time of Imam As-Sajjad Salamullah Alayhi after the Shahada of Imam Al-Husayn, which we have accounts that says irtadda an-nas illa thalatha. Everybody left Islam, true Islam, of course. People were Muslim, but true Islam. Everybody, those who were Shia, those who should have followed the Imam, didn't follow the Imam. Irtadda an-nas, except for three, except for five, except for seven. Very small numbers of Shia, very small numbers of the Muhibbeen, the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt. Gradually the momentum picked up, and we've explained instances of how during the time of the later Imams, the masses have developed a strong love towards the Ahlul Bayt. And you have influential figures within the government that are not only lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, but believers, theological believers of the Ahlul Bayt. They're a theological Shia, not simply a lover of the Ahlul Bayt. It's a very complex movement. I want to talk about a bit, I'll mention one example during the time of Imam Al-Askari to see what it's like, how the movement is progressed. So we can start to see that how, because of the progress, the fear of the Imams reaching a point that they're going to take over government is becoming more and more serious. Recite the salawat, please. There's a person that used to be a minister at the time of Mutawakkil during the time of Imam Al-Hadi. His name is Ubaidullah ibn Yahya ibn Khaqan. This man was a minister, a wazir of Mutawakkil. But he was put aside. Many other rulers came. It wasn't mentioned there, and it wasn't clear why he was removed from his position. But tonight we're going to find out why. He has a son. During the time of Imam Al-Askari, this man was reintroduced into the government. Right? In other words, he's a reputable man, he's well known, he's capable. And the Abbasid Khilafah, the government, has trust in him. At some point in time, they lost trust, they put him aside, but now they are bringing him back. Another ruler is bringing him back. All right. His son says, one day, I was in my father's office and his people came over and told him that Abu Muhammad is coming. Abu Muhammad. You know, the name of the Imam of our time is Muhammad. Alayhi salam. Muhammad. The same as the name of the Holy Prophet and the fifth Imam. And the kunya, therefore, of Imam Al-Askari is Abu Muhammad. He was known as Abu Muhammad. They said to his father, Abu Muhammad is coming. His son says, I was perplexed. Why? Because, look, in Arabic culture, mentioning the kunya of someone is a lot of respect. Instead of saying Hamza, for example, referring to me, if they would call me Abu Zahra, or Abu Muhammad, or Abu whatever, that would be respectful. It's a lot. There's a lot of respect. And if you don't say that, you just call them by the person's name, you're not giving that respect. That's why when we speak to the Ahlul Bayt, when we want to give salams, we don't say As-salamu alayk ya Hussein. We say As-salamu alayk ya Aba Abdullah. Okay. When we're talking to the Holy Prophet, Ya Aba Al-Qasim, Dua Tawassul, you say these kunyas. It's respect. It's showing respect. He says that nobody was given the respect of being mentioned by their kunya except for the Khalifa and one or two other people. So I was perplexed. Who is this person that's being mentioned by my father's people, his workers, by his kunya? And then when I saw him come in, I was even more shocked. Because he came in, my father went out when he heard he's coming. He went out, he brought him in, he was kissing his hand, he sat him where he was sitting, and so much respect, he describes the scene. He's just baffled, what's going on here? Who is this man? This is the wazir of the khalifa of the time, all right? Imam is coming where? In his office. He says, it's interesting, he says that all of this was going on. They brought news, if I remember correctly, the Khalifa, I could be wrong, it may have been one of the other wuzara, but if I remember correctly, it was actually the Khalifa himself. Said he's on his way. This man, Ubaydullah ibn Yahya ibn Khaqan, remains seated out of respect. They say he's coming. He doesn't do that. Remember with the Imam, when they brought him the news that the Imam is coming, he stood up, he went outside with all respect and utmost respect that he brought him in. Khalifa is coming. He was sitting there. When they said, okay, he's close, he's about to enter, the Imam tells him, okay, I think this man is coming. He says, yes, please, if you don't mind, please be in this room. And he tells his people, hide the Imam. Khalifa is coming. Look at what's going on. There is such a bond of trust between the Imam. It's like the Imam is all, it's almost as though the Imam is flexing here, showing his power to us, right? To know. He's going to the office of one of the wuzara, one of the ministers of the Khalifa, knowing that the Khalifa is going to be coming here as well. And all he has to do, there's this much trust that with all the secrecy they had to keep, which I've discussed over the course of these last nights, and we've talked about how letters had to be sent without names. The Imam was brought into Samarra with reasons because they wanted to keep him away from the Shia. So the relationship with the Shia had to be hush-hush. Nobody should have known. So trusting people was a big thing. This man is so close to the Imam that when the Khalifa is coming in, he tells the Imam to go in the room, and all of his people also, what? Nobody mentions anything to the Khalifa. He can be that close to the Khalifa of the time, the king, and be this close to the Imam, have this much respect, have this much love, have this much belief in the Imam of the time. Of his time, Imam al-Askari. Okay. This is not something that we have seen before. The son continues. He says, obviously, I'm just shocked here. This is the first time I'm seeing this, which also tells us something else. All right, to build on the concept of secrecy. The son of Ubaydullah ibn Yahya ibn Khaqan does not know his father is that close to the Ahlul Bayt, to Imam Al-Askari. He doesn't know him. There's certain people that you keep that information secret from. You don't release that information to them. You need to have trust. He says, I was perplexed. At this point, this is the first time I'm seeing this. And next day I go to my father and I stand there and he says, it seems like you have a question. I said, yeah, so who is this man? He says, interesting, again, the way this man is responding. These are all statements made out of taqiyya. That type of a relationship that I'll give another example of between Ubaydullah ibn Yahya ibn Khaqan and the Imam shows that most definitely this man is a believer in the Ahlul Bayt. Okay? No questions about it. But when he wants to respond to his son, who this man is, what does he say? He says he is Imamul Rafidah. He doesn't say he's my Imam. He doesn't say I believe in him. He says he's Imamul Rafidah. The Shia were called Rafidah. There are various notions as to why the Shia were referred to as Rafidah. Rafidah means the ones who reject. Rejecting what? There's probably a number of notions. One of them is that they say they rejected the Khilafah of the initial Khulafa, and they said that's not from the Prophet. That's one of the notions. There's probably a number of them as well. But anyway, Rafidah is a term that's developed to refer to the Shia. He He says he's Imam al-Rafida. When you first read that, when you don't understand the context, you think, oh, this is just a man that is respecting the Imam. No. Don't get it wrong. This is a real believer. The circumstances of taqiyya dictate that what he does when he wants to explain who this man is, he doesn't say he's my Imam, he says he's Imam al-Rafida. Another sign, this man, okay, and his relationship with the Imam. When Imam al-Askari was poisoned and he felt that this illness, this whatever the effect of the poison was, that we'll explain, inshallah, in the Masa'ib, what actually it did, the last moments of the Imam. But when he started to realize that it's affecting him, and it took him a while, some narrations and reports tell us that it was a week, others say it was 2 weeks. When he realized that he's been poisoned, Imam al-Askari sent his brother, all of these I believe have very important historic points, and these are clues that we need to understand the context that the Imam has lived in. It says the Imam sent who? He sent the one who is known as Ja'far al-Kadhab, the brother of the Imam. He says that he sends Ja'far al-Kadhab to who? To Ubaidullah ibn Yahya ibn Khaqan, and tells him, tell him that I am ill. It says that when he received the information that Imam is struggling with this illness, quickly he gets the best physicians in Samarra that are part of the government, the best doctors. He gets them and he sends them to the Imam to try to help him in whatever way they can. He gathers the most pious people in Samarra, some of whom are probably Shia, it's not mentioned and stated in that way, but there are clues that this is what the situation was. He gets them to go and make sure that the house of the Imam is protected. The Imam is receiving the support, the respect. If there's anything that needs to be done, they need to be there with him. This is the minister of the Khalifa, right? And many other examples of people being their property, their belongings being confiscated by the government, the Imam sending letters to those people that confiscated it to give it back to the person. All right. So this momentum, the movement of the Ahlul Bayt, we see has progressed and advanced further. So we see that influential figures closer and closer to the Khulafa are becoming Shia, are becoming followers of the Ahlul Bayt. And the fear that exists, see, the Khalifa, if you put yourself in his shoes, and the only way you can really start feeling that is if you start looking at a recent event. If you look at the revolution, the Islamic revolution in Iran, you start realizing what this means. You start realizing what this means. That when the channels, the students of the late Imam Khomeini, when they would pass around the statements of the Imam in all secrecy, they would print them and circulate them in the cities, in universities, amongst people, in the masajid, the fear that the Shah had was before Imam Khomeini came to the country, he left the country. Why? Why did he leave? He starts feeling that the masses are with this man. His own people, why did he leave? Did you know, before the success of the revolution, on the 22nd of Bahman, in the year 1357 of the Iranian calendar, in 1979, before the success of the revolution, one of the things that caused the success was what? The Air Force generals came and saluted Imam Khomeini. Okay. You see, when you see the picture and you try to picture what the scene was like, how things were developing, the Shah's government hadn't been seen, or they didn't really feel that this revolution is succeeding that quickly. It wasn't being seen. If it was, they would have killed Imam Khomeini. Okay, don't doubt that. They didn't think that it's going to happen that quickly. I've asked around. When you study that, it's not that clear. When you have the army officials, the air force officials that are supposed to be most loyal to their king, they switch sides and they go and salute Imam Khomeini, that broke the back of the regime. Okay? That's how you have to sort of understand this. A weak, and that's why we talked about the weakness of the Abbasid Khilafah. They've become weak. They have this fear, who's going to come and plot and kill them? Because this kept happening. The Khalifa would be killed. Somebody else would be put in. Next person, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of fear. And then you see that this movement is gaining momentum, more people supporting, even your own teachers that you bring from your children, as we mentioned last night, are Shia of the Ahlul Bayt. Your own wuzara are Shia of the Ahlul Bayt. When they start realizing this, then it becomes a very, very serious threat to the government. This is why 6 years was the time of the imamah of our beloved imam. This is why that if in the previous instances, in the previous cases, if Imam al-Ridha salamullah alayhi was assassinated in Marw, or close to Marw in Tus, his son Jawadul A'imma in Medina was left alive and kept alive. They didn't have a problem with him. They tried to actually train him to become a type of leader that they wanted to. When Imam al-Jawad is assassinated and he is poisoned, Imam al-Hadi is left alone. When Imam al-Hadi is poisoned, Imam al-Askari is left alone. But when Imam al-Askari is poisoned, the government sends their people to look for any children that the Imam has. It's not because they've received and they believe in the Holy Prophet and they say that the Holy Prophet has said that the son of the 11th Imam is going to be the upriser. It's because they're under serious pressure. They're feeling that we've tested this. An 8-year-old son or an 8-year-old boy becomes the leader of the movement and he manages the affairs of the believer and makes life difficult for the Khalifa. Imam al-Jawad, a 6-year-old boy, if Imam al-Hadi was 6, according to one of the accounts. A 6-year-old boy is able to lead the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. We can't allow for children to remain alive. That's it. We've had enough of this. So this is to show what the Imam did during his lifetime, basically following through with what the developments were from the previous imams. But there's something even more important that we're going to start talking about tonight, but it's something that will have to carry on and carry over to the time of the occultation, the time of the imamah of our beloved imam of our time, Hujjatullahi fi ardih, imam of our time, Imam Sahib al-Zaman, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif. What is it, if we picture the reality of what has happened, those who've been in these sessions and we've seen the buildup of the momentum. Okay. Now what happens is, Imam al-Askari is the last Imam before the occultation. The occultation is a very difficult setting for the Shia. We talked about this before, and it only makes sense that a movement will be alive with its leadership. If you get rid of the leadership, what's going to happen? That's the end of the movement. That's why they tried to kill the imams. They wanted to kill the head of the movement. So now what's going to happen is, after Imam al-Askari, the Imam will be going into occultation. He's alive, but people don't have contact with him. This is going to be difficult. How do you keep this movement that you have nurtured, and you have, with everything you have, the Ahlul Bayt have given lives, their companions have given lives to get where it is now, and now the Imam wants to go into occultation. One of the questions that comes to mind before, you know, trying to answer that previous question is, does it even make sense for the Imam to go into occultation? Why does it make sense for the Imam to go into occultation? If this movement is growing, is being nurtured to develop into an Islamic government, as we have mentioned, then why, after all this progress, suddenly the Imam of our time is supposed to go into occultation? How does that make sense? What did the Imams do to prepare the Shia for this time, to make sure that this is going to go through, and the Shia is going to live through this, and not only not die out, but to grow? But to grow. What did the Ahlul Bayt do? If we compare the time of Imam al-Husayn and his Shahada, and the time of Imam al-Askari and his Shahada, or even the time of Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi and his Shahada, and Imam al-Askari and his Shahada, or Imam al-Kadhim, or Imam al-Ridha, if we look at these Imams, one of the questions I like to always ask, why didn't these Imams go into occultation? One of the things we find in hadith about the reason of occultation is this. It says, Imam al-Sadiq talked about it. He told people that the 12th Imam is going to be going into occultation. Why is he going into occultation? He put his hand on his chest and he said, Ya khaf ala nafsi. He is afraid of what they will do to him. The Imam is afraid that they're going to kill him? Well, all the previous Imams were killed. It's not simply the fear of getting killed. None of the Imams. The Imams, according to the way they have described believers, much less Imams, the believers in the Imams are longing for the moment of death. فَمَنْ يَرْجُوا لِقَاءَ رَبِّهِ يَرْجُوا in Surah Al-Kahf. Whoever likes to meet their Lord, death is the moment. That's when you're free of this material body and you can meet your Lord. None of the Imams were afraid of that. The reason why that is mentioned is because the death of the Imam would mean the end of the story. Why is it that the death of the previous Imams was something that wasn't prevented? Why didn't they go into occultation? Why didn't Imam al-Sadiq go into occultation? If you've been listening to the sequence of events and how things have developed, we sort of know part of that, and we need to add another part to it, another explanation. One of them, which we talked about last night, I think a bit more than before, was that the knowledge of the deen, of the religion, which is the foundation based on which everything else is formed, including the political movement, we talked about how important that ideology is. And that's a clear distinction between this movement and any other political movement, is that it's rooted in an ideology that believes in the unseen, believes in God, believes and has a perspective of this world that needs to be understood by those who want to follow that school of thought and want to take those political stances. You can't take those political stances without this ideological foundation. At the time of Imam al-Husayn salamullah alayhi, that ideology wasn't there. People didn't know a lot of things. Whether it's ahkam, whether it's aqa'id, very superficial understandings of the verses of the Qur'an. There was the ban of hadith during the time of the first khalifa, it was banned. The knowledge of the Holy Prophet, what was with the people, it didn't get circulated and people didn't know that knowledge. Very superficial. Why do you think the Khawarij were able to have those very strict, superficial understandings and say, لا حكم إلا لله, and understand that to mean that there's no government except for God's governance in the creatures? Why is it that Muawiyah is able to convince people to fabricate hadith? Because the knowledge of the Holy Prophet is not amongst the masses. We mentioned when we talked about Imam al-Baqir that he started, the reason why he's called Baqir, the one who splits the seed of knowledge and opens it up, is because that knowledge wasn't present. The Ahlul Bayt, little by little, over the course of these years, after what happened in Karbala, they started to give that knowledge to the masses. When you look at what Imam al-Sadiq has given, you see a lot of ahkam. It's not only ahkam, there's other things as well, but most of our ahkam comes from Imam al-Sadiq. When you see Imam al-Kadhim, there's a lot of ahkam still. When you start moving towards the later imams, you see more difficult and challenging matters of ideology and faith, like ilm al-ghayb, like more profound understandings of tawheed, and more profound understandings of the Ahlul Bayt and who they are. As we mentioned last night, the ziyarah, which is known as ziyarah Jami'a Kabira, this information is being given to the people. Without the knowledge of the religion being given to the people, it would not make sense for an imam to go into occultation. No, he needs to be there. He needs to build that ideology and present it to the people. That's why before Imam al-Askari, saving the lives of the imams, or even Imam al-Askari himself, and them going into occultation is not possible. But there's a second element to that, which is related, very much tied into that. There's something we need to understand, brothers and sisters. The knowledge of Islam, whether it's in the Holy Quran or any hadith, if it is in any book, the mere presence of books is not going to ensure the continuity of an ideology. Books are not going to do that. If Imam al-Sadiq would have just written books, couldn't he have done that if he just wanted to give the knowledge out? Couldn't he have just written books and made copies of it and just sent it to people? Couldn't he have done that? Couldn't Imam al-Baqir have done that? He did. Imam Zain al-Abidin, he had some letters, he wrote them and he said, make copies of these, read them on a weekly basis. He ordered his companions to read them on a weekly basis. But he could have just written it and say, here you go, this is the knowledge. I've written the books, I'm done, that's it. That's not going to ensure it. What did they have to do? They had to build people that were going to be the ones that are going to carry on with this. They had to make sure that when they leave, the people, there is enough of them and they are strong enough to be able to carry this very weighty movement, this very difficult movement, this great responsibility, move it forward. This is what the Ahlul Bayt have done. Remember we said they had layers that they worked on, they had the general masses, that it was simply the love of the Ahlul Bayt that they had. But then there were two other layers. There were a layer of the Shia that believed theologically in the Ahlul Bayt, but they were just average Shias. Then you had the closest to the Ahlul Bayt. These closest individuals to the Ahlul Bayt were trained scholars, ulama, pious people that would carry on the movement of the Ahlul Bayt. The system that is known as the system of wikala, and we'll start to talk more about this tomorrow night, inshallah. The wikala, the niyaba, the four na'ibs, nawab that you know of, starting with Uthman ibn Sa'id al-Amri, who was actually a wakil of the 9th Imam and 10th and 11th, Imam al-Jawad, Imam al-Hadi, and Imam al-Askari, who became the first na'ib of the Imam of our time as well. This system of niyaba, or the system of wikala, which was people that had gained this knowledge, not only the knowledge, the faith, the piety, they had trained these people, not these people are trained, they can carry on that. This is the, I have mentioned in other centers at other times, this is truly the miracle of the Ahlul Bayt. Why is that? I'll try to make this brief. If you look at all religions, including part of Islam, okay, who changes the religions that God sends to guide people? Who changes them? Who caused the change and the alteration of Judaism? Who caused the Jews that were supposed to be believing in God, that were supposed to be believing in the hereafter, that supposed to believe in their prophet, when the prophets that came and they knew these are prophets of God, they would plot and they would kill them? Who caused that to happen? Who caused them to reject Jesus? Some of us know at least the story of Jesus when he came. He is a prophet for Bani Israel. The Quran tells us. The Jews knew this is a prophet for Bani Israel. He's supposed to guide them, he's supposed to lead them. Instead of accepting him, they rejected him. They said, no, this is not the prophet, although they knew. The Jews knew the prophet of Islam, according to the verse of the Holy Quran, it says that they knew the prophet the way they would know their own child. That's how much description they had in their scripture about how the prophet was going to look, what he was going to say, where he was going to be. They knew all of that. But what made them such that when the prophet moved to Medina and he gave them all the signs, the mushrikeen would believe, the Jews wouldn't believe. They wouldn't accept that. Who caused that? According to the verses of the Holy Quran, the scholars of those religions. اتخذوا أحبارهم ورهبانهم أربابا من دون الله. The Ahlul Bayt, over the course of these years, with all the difficulty, trained believers that they had enough trust to entrust these believers, these wukala, these nawab, with the religion that is supposed to remain until the day of judgment, and they had trust in them that they're not going to change it. They will accept to be tortured to death, but they will not change it. This is the miracle of the Ahlul Bayt. When they had Sayyid Muhammad Baqir As-Sadr rahmatullah alayh in prison, the mal'oon, the animal Saddam, which is a disgrace to animals to call him an animal, when he had him in prison, they tortured him in ways that is difficult to even mention. For him to issue fatawa against Islam, he took the torture, he didn't make those fatwas. After 1,000 years, brothers and sisters, after 1,000 years, this is the product of what the Ahlul Bayt have made. These people wouldn't have become who they are if it wasn't the training of the Ahlul Bayt. Generation after generation, they've handed down that knowledge, that piety, and you have this still. This is what Imam al-Askari had to do. It says that the night of the Shahada of Imam al-Askari, the night which, as the descriptions go, it says at Fajr time, this poison had enough effect on him that when he wanted to have water and he asked to make wudu and to be able to drink it, when he asked for water, they brought him water. When he wanted to hold the cup to bring it to his mouth, his hand was shivering so much he couldn't do it. Right. He asked for his son the Imam of our time, to come and give him water. Salamullah alayh. This, the night before it reached the stage, it says the Imam kept writing letters and letters and letters and letters, and sent them out with all the problems he had, with all the difficulty in getting these letters out. He had created the channel, he had people that were able in all secrecy take this and distribute it, so the people, the believers, would be saved and they would know their path from that point onwards. This is how the Ahlul Bayt fought. This is what the Ahlul Bayt did. When I was reading those lines about Imam Al-Askari the night before his Shahada, in those circumstances, what he's thinking about and what he's doing is this: guiding the people till the last minute of his life. As-salamu alaykum يا أهل بيت النبوة وموضع الرسالة ومختلف الملائكة ومهبط الوحي ومعدن الرحمن وخزان العلم ومنتهى الحلم. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you. It was in your homes that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blessed us with guidance and revelation. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, angels descend upon you day in and day out, seeking permission before entering upon you. Let's take our hearts to Samarra again, to the house of the Imam of our time, with our beloved Imam Al-Askari. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Muhammad ya Hasan ibn Ali ayyuha al-zakiy wal-askari. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you, my beloved Imam Al-Askari, I apologize, Ya Mawla, even these days you're maghloob, you're ghareeb. No one visits your grave because of the insecurity that there is. Even your grave is a threat to the enemies of Islam.
روحي لك الفداء. Brothers and sisters, imagine your Imam with the difficulties he's having, struggling with the effects of the poison, the night of his Shahada. He's writing letters to guide you and I. Closer to Fajr time, he asks for water, they take him water. He wants to drink it, he picks up the cup. His hand is shivering, he cannot drink. He tells the servant, go in this room of the house. You'll see a young boy, you tell him to come. The servant is not aware, the son of the Imam is there. She opens the door, the Imam calls him. He says, O Hujjatullah, come, these are the last moments of your father. He's thirsty, give him water. The 12th Imam comes. Imagine the pain that the Imam of your time is feeling, seeing his father in those circumstances, having to give him water, helping him make his wudu. Assalamu alaikum. Brothers and sisters, I wish Imam Zainul Abidin in the plains of Karbala was able to go with some water to give to the beloved Imam Al-Husayn. Brothers and sisters, the story of the thirst in Karbala is a very painful one. Some of the things that have been written in history books you have not heard. Some accounts say the Imam had made it. Eventually, at one point, Imam Al-Husayn made it to the Sharia. He picked up some water to drink. The mal'oon shot an arrow that pierced the mouth of the Imam. Sallallahu alayhi. Ya Aba Abdullah, Ya Hussein ibn Ali, Ayyuha al-Shaheed bi Karbala atshana. Ala la'natullahi ala al-qawm al-zalimin. وسيعلم الذين ظلموا أي منقلب ينقلبون. اللهم إنا نسألك وندعوك باسمك العظيم الأعظم الزهراء وأبيها وبعلها وبنيها والسر المستودع فيها بك يا الله 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 يا رحمن يا رحيم يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلوبنا على دينك وعلى محبة أوليائك. O Allah, our most important request to you on this night is that you hasten the return of our beloved Imam, that you help us become his true soldiers, his true companions, those who give everything they have, including their lives, for their Imam. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect and prolong the life of all those helping the cause of Islam, especially the Maraja, and especially our beloved leader. Ya Allah, we ask you on this night, by the right and the truth of Imam al-Askari, we have many sins. Our eyes have committed sins, our ears have committed sins, our hands, our feet, all our body parts. Ya Allah, we confess these are the sins that are preventing us from seeing our Master, the Imam of our time. We ask you by the right and the truth of his father, Imam al-Askari, that you forgive us all of our sins. Help us avoid sins from this night onwards. Ya Allah, we ask you to forgive our parents, our grandparents, our relatives, all believers, those who are alive, those who have left this world. Ya Allah, we have hajat. We have needs. Remember your brothers and sisters, relatives, members of the community, members of other communities, the lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, the believers, the Muslimin. Ya Allah, by the right and the truth of this Hujjah of yours, Imam al-Askari, we ask you to grant all believers their hajat, relieve all of them from hardship and difficulty, cure all the ill from amongst them. Ya Allah, brothers and sisters have been suffering in Iraq and more recently in Gaza. We ask you, Ya Allah, by the right and the truth of Imam al-Askari, you bring their pains, their difficulties to an end by removing their enemies from the face of the earth, inshaAllah. Ya Allah, we ask you that you relieve all the people of the world of the oppressions they're facing. Bin Nabiya wa Alih, Rahimallah, man qara'a al-Fatihata ma'as-salawat.